Nature's Archive Podcast, a Jumpstart Nature production.
Have you ever seen a really fuzzy looking ant? Maybe it looked like a little pipe cleaner with fuzzy red or yellow hair crawling along the ground. If so, you probably saw a velvet ant. But here's the thing, it's not even an ant at all. They're wingless wasps, and they often turn up along hiking trails, roadsides, and occasionally even in your backyard. And if you haven't seen one, hit pause and check out the show notes at naturesarchive.com for a few photos. You have to see them. What's more, these wasps have quite the reputation and an amazing natural history. So with me today is Dr. Joseph Wilson. He's an evolutionary ecologist and associate professor of biology at Utah State University. Dr. Wilson is also the co-author of a new book, Velvet Ants of North America, as well as the wildly popular The Bees in Your Backyard. I've always been fascinated with velvet ants, but found precious little about them online. I purchased the book and reached out to Dr. Wilson, and he graciously agreed to share some of his knowledge today. For example, did you know that some velvet ants have an auditory warning? And about half of the velvet ant species are actually nocturnal. We discuss why we often see velvet ants deterministically wandering near trails, why they're often and inaccurately called cow killers, and more. But I couldn't have a chat with Dr. Wilson and not talk about bees. So we kick things off with some discussion of bees, buzz pollination, and more before transitioning to velvet ants. So without additional delay, Dr. Joseph Wilson. Dr. Wilson, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome.
As we were just chatting here before hitting the record button, I've been a fan of your work on bees for a while and own one of your books. And I don't know what took me so long to reach out to you, but the reason I did this time was not bees, not what maybe a lot of our listeners know you for, but velvet ants. I see that you have a new book coming up soon. So I think we're going to have a fun meandering discussion today.
Yeah, I hope so.
And I'll try to cover both for that matter. But maybe just for a little bit of background and context, can you tell me a bit about where you grew up and how you got interested in nature?
Yeah. So I grew up mostly in Utah, Provo, Orem, Utah. So south of Salt Lake City in the suburbs. And growing up in the suburbs in the Great Basin, so the part of Utah I was in is part of the Great Basin Desert. It's biodiverse in its own way, but I was really into nature documentaries and field guides even as a kid. I remember, I think it was third grade, I had to get special permission not to read storybooks, but to be able to read field guides in school. And my mom went and talked to the teacher and they let me read field guides because I would love to just learn about the animals and plants and look at their distribution maps. And I remember often being disappointed that many of the things I saw in my field guides were not in suburban Utah. But we had a decent-sized backyard, and there were some wilder parts of the yard. And while I didn't see turtles and frogs and things like that that I wanted to see, there was always insects around. And so even from a young age, I was noticing insects and being fascinated by insects. There were no documentaries about insects at the time, but I was still able to maybe get my animal fix by observing insects in the backyard.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I'm listening to you telling that story and thinking about my childhood. And I too enjoyed nature documentaries and would spend time outside and see the insects, but I never really equated them in the same way that you're describing. I wonder what it is about some people who, when they see insects, they just have that extra fascination with them.
Yeah, it's interesting because none of my family are biologically inclined in the same way as me. My parents aren't biologists or anything, but they would say I was biologically inclined from birth. My dad tells the story that when I was 2 years old, he heard that you should sit down and have interviews with your kids periodically. And as a two-year-old, there's not a lot you can ask your kids about. He was trying to be a good dad, so he sat me down and asked what I wanted to be when I grew up. And he tells me that I told him I wanted to be a lion when I grew up. And so in his mind, that was evidence that I was always kind of a biologist. Even as a two-year-old, I was thinking about animals. That's what I wanted to be, is an animal, not something else.
Are you still striving to be a lion in some respect?
I actually use that in some of my bios that I give. And I say I never made it to lionhood, but being a biology professor is pretty close.
Yeah, yeah, I see that. I can see that.
And the reason I bring it up, because with the insect thing, in animal documentaries, there's lots of things about African savannas. And there's always some kind of conflict between the predator and the prey. Often it's a lion or it's a cheetah or something like that. And I think why I was able to get behind bugs broadly is you have all those different roles among insects and their relatives. You have the predators and you have the prey and you have the herbivores and just all these dynamics that are being played out. So there's still the kind of intrigue and drama that you see in those nature documentaries, but it's happening in your backyard underneath your leaf pile or whatever. So I think I was able to make those connections, maybe subconsciously, that there was some exciting stuff happening in the world of insects in the backyard.
Yeah, totally. And that's one of the things that I advocate people pay more attention to their yards. And when you start to see that happening and the different hunting strategies that different insects or spiders or whatever you find take, really is very similar on a small scale in your own backyard.
Yeah.
Were you from this early age interested in bees and wasps, or did that come later?
No, it came later. There's two kind of versions of the story. I do remember, so in sixth grade, we had to make an insect collection as part of our curriculum. And I already had one because I was already interested in insects. But I do remember finding bees that were not just honeybees and having just a recognition in my mind, oh, there's other things besides honeybees. But that's as far as it went until college. So through high school, I was still interested in biology. I started college and was interested in biology. I thought I wanted to study the charismatic megafauna, bears or wolves or something like that. And so I started a school at Utah State University in the College of Natural Resources. They have a wildlife management program there. Within that first semester, I realized that wildlife management was focused more on the management side of things and less on the ecology or biology of the things. And I wasn't really that interested in management. I don't like the management aspect. I just want to know what these organisms are doing, not necessarily how can we as humans manipulate the system, is how I was seeing it. So I was making this shift over into the biology, which wasn't doing the management side. But at the same time, I met a girl who was super cool, and she just barely had gotten back from a summer research job studying bees in southern Utah. She was working for the USDA Bee Lab, and she just basically spent the previous 4 months out in the backcountry of southern Utah collecting wild bees. And so she reintroduced me to this idea of wild bees. And as I became better friends with her and pursued a relationship with her, she got a job for me at the USDA Bee Lab as an undergrad. So she's now my wife, and she graduated with a natural resources degree, but I stayed with that job that she got me in bees and stayed with bees and expanded to wasps. So there's the long version of the story.
Gotcha. And I guess drilling in, it expanded to wasps, and now maybe tease a little bit the velvet ant part of the discussion. So how did velvet ants get into the picture?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's not always a simple transition. So as an undergrad, I was working with the bee lab. I ended up doing some undergrad research projects and heading some bee-based studies. And then realizing I wanted to do graduate school, I made the conscious decision not to become just a bee biologist. It's really easy to do, especially in biology in graduate school. You get so specialized that that is what you are. And while I really liked bees, I wanted to make sure I was looking at other options. And in hindsight, expanding to wasps really isn't that different. But as an undergrad working in the bee lab, I met a professor that was just new at Utah State University that specialized in wasps. He came out in the field with me for my research, and we became friends. And he's the one that suggested pursuing graduate work with something other than bees. He was working on velvet ants, which are a kind of wingless wasp, and convinced me that there was a lot of work to do with velvet ants. And so that's where I went. And he was able to help me take my interests and use velvet ants as a study subject to answer the biological questions that I was really interested in.
So velvet ants are maybe not charismatic megafauna, but they're charismatic in their own right. And I think when people see one, it's hard to ignore them and hard not to ask questions about them.
Exactly. Well, and what's interesting with that is we see those bright, fuzzy velvet ants. That's what people are familiar with. But that's only half of the diversity in North America. The other half are nocturnal velvet ants, which are not bright and not as fuzzy. And my PhD work was actually on those, these nocturnal velvet ants.
Yeah, and I was largely oblivious to nocturnal velvet ants until preparing for this interview, in fact.
Yeah. Well, I think almost everybody is, including other entomologists.
Really, really. I do want to table the velvet ant discussion for a moment, and let's just talk bees for a few minutes before we get there. And partly because I suspect that a fair number of my listeners do recognize you and your name from the work you've done in the world of bees. And in particular, I think the book that a lot of folks are familiar with is The Bees in Your Backyard, which you were co-author of, and there's a corresponding website. So I'd love to hear about why you decided to publish a book and what your goal with that book was.
In the bee lab, when I was working in the bee lab, there was a graduate student. She was my supervisor in a lot of these different roles I was playing as an undergrad. Her name was Olivia Messenger at the time. It's now Olivia Messenger Carroll. And so we stayed friends. She's really good friends with my wife. We've stayed friends since I worked with her. And she went on to get a PhD studying some chemical ecology of bees. I went on to get a PhD in wasps. But during this time, we were still in contact. And we noticed that culturally, there was this shift in this cultural understanding and awareness of bees. People were being more aware of their importance. But we were keenly aware that there was no resource available to a general public about bees. And so there was mistakes being made. We would often see news stories talking about how important bees are, but they would only focus on honeybees, which are not a native species. And I consider them more of an agricultural commodity. They're not wildlife. And so Olivia and I, we had both worked with native bees almost exclusively and knew the importance in ecosystems and all the really interesting stuff about native bees, we got together and said, hey, let's make a book that is academically rigorous and accurate, but is geared more towards not just academics. We didn't want to make it only to like a lay audience. We wanted it to be applicable for academics and others alike. And so that's where The Bees in Your Backyard came out. We wanted it to be an introduction to bees so people could learn about bees and fall in love with bees with accurate information.
Mm. I think you hit the mark pretty well. I was mentioning before that we've had nice weather here and around 7 or 8 different bee species in my front yard the other morning. And I pulled your book back out to help refamiliarize myself with some of what I was seeing. And yeah, you have it organized by family and characteristics of the family and photos of collection specimens, but also individuals in the field. So it's a nice mix of being able to look at the insects up close and then also in situ in the field.
Yeah, I have realized that pictures from the field are so invaluable because when you're looking at a dead specimen, whether it's a bee or a velvet ant, sitting on a pin, it generally is in a position that you never will see in real life. You can look at it closer or in different ways. And so seeing what a bee looks like when it's on a flower helps with this search image. And it also gives the scale perspective. A bee on a pin, they all look the same size, but really there's a huge diversity of sizes of bees. And I think that is helpful. So me and Olivia both were hobbyist photographers. So we took 90% of the pictures from that book because that was the fun part, go chase bees in the field and take pictures of them.
Nice. So you mentioned that part of the reason for the book was because of some of the misinformation and growing interest in bees. And, you know, unfortunately, I still see news stories where it'll be about bees, but the photo might be of a bee fly or a syrphid fly or something like that. So there's still some room to grow. But in general, how have you seen knowledge of bee conservation progress since the publication of this book?
It really varies geographically, which is interesting. In some parts of the country, there has been a huge shift that people are well aware of native bees and really enthusiastic about providing for native bees. Other parts of the country still are in that infancy stage when they're still trying to figure out what the difference is between a fly and a bee. And so, like, for example, Oregon and Washington here in the West culturally have this movement to understand the native bees of those countries. And there's volunteers that are going out and photographing them for iNaturalist. And there's professorships that they have started there focusing on pollination and native bees. So some parts of the country like that, Ohio is similar. Ohio has a lot of things going on with native bees. Then other parts like Utah, where I'm at, there still hasn't been a big change. People still are unsure what a bee is versus a fly. And so I give a lot of seminars every year, and I focus for the first 20 minutes of these hour-long seminars on how to tell the difference between a bee, a fly, and a wasp, and then just telling people what bees are and what they do is where we're at still culturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's such an anchor of like maybe an anchoring bias with honeybees and what most people's expectation of a bee is. And then when like almost anything in nature, it seems like the same story exists for so many different taxa. But when you start learning about them, oh, there's so much diversity and they behave differently and act differently and look differently than maybe people expect.
Yeah. And one of the, when we first started this, a lot of people would make statements similar to like the idea that, well, if people are interested in honeybees, at least it's starting, like at least it's making them aware. And there's some truth to that. The danger is honeybees, like I mentioned, they're not wild animals, but more than that is that if you have too many honeybees in an area, it can have a negative effect on the native bee communities. And so a lot of people and organizations and even conservation organizations were increasing honeybee hives in their areas. There would be city libraries that would bring honeybee hives onto their rooftop gardens because they thought they were helping bees. And the reality is that in a lot of cases, that was negatively impacting the wild bee communities. And so while some people were resistant to this movement away from honeybees, it's becoming more and more clear that honeybees as the poster child for saving the bees is probably the wrong direction. It's a great hobby. If you're a beekeeper and you want to keep bees, it's a really cool hobby, can be really fun. It just needs to be done wisely. You can't just bring honeybee hives in and assume that everything will be fine.
Hey, nature enthusiast, do you want to be part of something bigger? Well, we're building a movement at Jumpstart Nature, and we've just added some new volunteers to help with our podcast and website. But this means our costs are going up too. I need to purchase software licenses to give them access to the production tools we use. For example, one media editing license costs $21 a month. And this is where you come in. Please consider supporting our mission by contributing to Jumpstart Nature through our Patreon or direct contributions, or even purchasing some logo merch. Check out all these options at jumpstartnature.com/donate, also linked in the show notes. Not ready to make a financial contribution? Then please share this episode with three friends. Sharing what we do is actually one of the very best ways you can help us. Thank you all for your continued support. So maybe this is a good transition to talk about some of the biggest misconceptions that people might have about bee conservation and native bees. And this is very open-ended, but it could be behavior, the types of habitats they need, or any area that comes to mind for you.
I think that what we were just talking about is where the biggest misconception lies, is that this idea of what a bee is with a queen and a hive and honey and worker bees, those are all these facts, and I'm doing air quotes here. Those are facts about bees, but they only really apply to honeybees. There are 4,000 different kinds of bees in North America, north of Mexico, so United States and Canada, 4,000 different kinds of bees. And only one of them lives in these big hives with queens and workers and honey, and it's the honeybee, which is not from here. And you'll see things like, and I throw some celebrities under the bus because they're celebrities, but because they got a lot of attention. So Morgan Freeman several years ago got a lot of attention because he has a big property in Mississippi, and he decided to make it into a bee sanctuary. So he brought 30 beehives in, he hired beekeepers to keep those beehives healthy, and he planted fields of lavender and clover for those beehives. But what he just did is he now increased the number of bees on his property from whatever was there naturally, increasing it by 30 hives. Each hive has 50,000 bees in it. So that's a lot of new bees in the environment. And then planting fields of lavender and clover, what people don't realize is not all bees like lavender and clover. There are a lot of, I say they're picky eaters as bees, but we call them specialists. A lot of wild bees will specialize on certain kinds of flowers. And so if you plant lavender and clover, that will do almost nothing for the longhorn bees, which is a big category of bees that don't really visit lavender and clover very much.
So he may have increased the population of honeybees, but decreased the population of the native bees by taking that action.
Exactly. Without even recognizing that there were native bees there. Similar, Rolling Stone magazine highlighted the bass player for Red Hot Chili Pepper, Flea. Mm-hmm. He also is a hobbyist beekeeper. And so they did this story about how Flea is saving the bees. And the problem is those are the stories that get attention, but without recognizing that honeybees are really not like all other bees, we can make this cultural awareness of bees equals honeybees, and that can be wrong. It's not can be wrong, it is wrong.
Yeah.
Honeybees are not equal to bees.
When you mentioned Flea, I feel like maybe he is an entomologist who maybe took a wrong turn at some point, just with his name.
I know. I always wonder that. What's his background? Where's his interest in insects?
Yep.
And how can I talk to him about native bees?
I'll put the call out. I don't have connections to Flea. Who knows?
Tell him to call me.
And speaking of bee conservation, I was just going to comment about a great story that I actually had on the podcast. Oh, it's probably been a year ago now. It seems like yesterday. But an amateur melittologist, Crystal Hickman in Southern California, who has gotten into the photography and searching for the rare and hard to find bees in California. Just an amazing story. And I guess that's one of those success stories of somebody getting inspired and reaching a new audience with the story of native bees.
She has some great pictures too. She does a lot of good work.
Mm-hmm. One more bee question, I think, before we finally move on to velvet ants. But I was thinking about something that I wanted to ask Crystal about, or some of my other guests, but always missed. That's buzz pollination. So this may seem random, like a random question, but can you tell me what buzz pollination is and how it works?
Yeah. Is it okay if I take a little bit of a step back before that?
Certainly. Yes.
To set the stage, I tell people about native bees. Most people know honeybees are pollinators. We kind of associate honeybees with pollination, and honeybees can be good pollinators. But in some crops, so I'll give apple orchards as an example, the job that 100 honeybees can do in an apple orchard can be done the same by two native bees. Based on these studies of pollen transfer and all these things like that. And so people might ask, well, why are native bees sometimes so much more efficient? The apple orchard's not a great example with buzz pollination, but it does work for things like tomatoes and eggplants and blueberries. All of those plants will produce bigger fruit and more fruit per plant when they have buzz pollination. Some plants, the flower doesn't easily release the pollen. It almost has it in like a little compartment. And if you shake the flower will drop the pollen out like a salt shaker. So buzz pollination is this ability that many wild bees have. Honeybees never evolved that ability. So buzz pollination, they can do it in different ways, but basically they are vibrating their muscles without flapping their wings sometimes. So they're just vibrating, and that causes the pollen to fall out of these flowers. And in the act of the pollen falling out, it sometimes will pollinate the flower better, self-pollinate or otherwise. So you get bigger blueberries when you have buzz pollinators. You get bigger tomatoes when you have buzz pollinators. Honeybees don't know how to do it. Many, many wild bees can buzz pollinate. Sometimes they will actually internally, they unhook their wings from their wing muscle and vibrate their wing muscle. So it sounds like they're buzzing, but really they're just vibrating.
Hmm. And from what I remember, some plants and some bees, there's specific frequencies of the buzz that are optimal.
Yeah. And I can't remember what it is because I'm not a musician, but someone actually measured it and it was like a D or something like that. So it's this close relationship between native bees and many native plants because they have evolved together. And so the bees that are best at pollinating certain plants might buzz at a certain frequency that causes the plant to release more pollen. Yeah. So there's a lot of interesting kind of stories of relationships like that. Some with buzz pollination, others with just specialized features that the bee that has evolved with the flower is often best at pollinating that flower.
And I think that's just so fascinating. It's a look at evolution where the plant is able to reproduce with the same genetics that allowed it to be buzz pollinated in the first place. And the benefit of doing so is it has a more efficient pollinator, it has bigger fruits, it has more seeds. You can see how this all fits together. It's amazing.
Well, and it's really interesting. Something that I've never really studied, but it's always fascinated me, is there are many crops that now we use around the world that were originally domesticated by Native Americans anciently. That includes things like potatoes and tomatoes and a lot of squash plants and things like that. These were all plants or crops that weren't available worldwide until the last 500 years, but they were here for a long time. And so there are lots of bees here that are co-evolved with these plants that Native Americans developed, like buzz pollinators, or there's a certain kind of bee that only visits squash plants. So that's really effective at pollinating pumpkins and zucchinis, and especially all these native squashes that were originally domesticated in Mexico thousands of years ago. So it's interesting to see how, as humans were domesticating these plants, bees were also evolving alongside with that and aiding in the agricultural aspect of these domesticated plants.
Yeah, very, very interesting. All right. I think as much as I could talk about bees for forever, I think we should probably move on to the velvet ants that we've been teasing for a while.
Yeah, that works for me.
You mentioned that velvet ants are actually a type of wasp, and I guess that's maybe one of the first surprises. So tell me a bit about what a velvet ant is.
Yeah, there is a family of wasps. The family is Mutilidae that are found around the world commonly, or they're known as lots of different things around the world, but most often they're referred to as velvet ants. The females of Mutilid wasps are all wingless, and so they look like big, fuzzy ants, velvet ants, because many of them have this bright hair covering their body.
It makes you want to touch them. It makes you want to pet them.
Exactly. They look super fuzzy and cute, but they have the longest stinger compared to their body out of any bee, wasp, or ant. We did a study on that. And those people that get stung by various Hymenoptera and rank velvet ants as one of the more painful stings. It's a tricky name because they're not ants and they're not really that velvety, but as common names go, we don't always get to choose the most scientifically sound common name for things.
Well, I guess as common names go, they have a common name of cow killer, which goes along with that powerful sting.
Exactly. And so people often ask me about that. So I should say they cannot kill a cow. They have never killed a cow. And in fact, their venom, which is potentially really potent as far as pain goes, it is really not dangerous as far as lethality goes. People have done these studies and it's not a toxic, or it's not highly toxic. It's just highly good at causing pain, if that's the way to say it.
Got it.
So cow killer, the idea is some rancher somewhere a long time ago got stung by one of these and said, ow, that hurt bad enough to kill a cow. So that's where the name came from, potentially.
So you started to talk a bit about the diversity and the fact that this family, it's found all over the world. Can you tell me a little bit more? Let's explore the diversity a little bit more, I suppose.
Yeah, and I should have looked up in my own book with this, because I don't have a good number of how many species there are. But we can talk about why. Here, I'll pull my book off and see what we say. There's actually, in the introduction, we have a whole section about this, because one of the reasons I studied velvet ants for my dissertation work is because there's so much unknown about them, including how many species there are. When we were doing work on nocturnal velvet ants, we would put up little traps, basically a fluorescent light that we would lure the male velvet ants to. Males can fly. Most of them can fly. And so they would come to these lights like a moth comes to your porch. But in that 4 or 5 years of working on my PhD with the co-author of this book, Kevin Williams, I think we found something like 70 new species of velvet ant in the deserts of Western North America. And so all over the world, when people are looking for velvet ants, they're always finding new species. So to ask how many species there are worldwide, we don't know for sure, but there are thousands. How many species are in the U.S.? Again, we don't know for sure, but there's around 450-ish. So besides being understudied, which would mean that there's probably more species to discover, as we look more into them and look at them genetically, we also did a lot of work finding that two specimens that look distinct, maybe one of them is orange and one of them is half black and half orange, genetically found out that they were actually the same thing. So things that used to be known as two species are now known as one species, and it just has multiple color patterns. And so there's a lot of movement as far as how many species there are, because sometimes we're expanding that by finding new things. Sometimes we're contracting that by realizing two, or some, in some cases, nine different, what we called species are actually just one species.
How much of that speciation or maybe splitting of species is driven by DNA versus other methods?
That's a good question. A lot of my work was looking at the historical geography and how that influenced speciation. So looking over the last 14 million years or so of North America, some mountains got higher, like the Sierra Nevadas. Some areas got lower, like parts of the Great Basin, the valleys would get lower. Sometimes there was inland seas that were present, like down in Southern California. There was basically a sea that separated San Diego from everywhere over by Las Vegas because the Sea of Cortez extended farther north. So I was looking at all these kind of factors and then looking at the genetics of the velvet ants to see if I could attribute any of these kind of geographical events to the evolutionary events in the velvet ants. And it's a complex story with hundreds of species changing for different reasons. Sometimes they were ice age level changes because Western North America was colder. Sometimes they were pre-ice age events, like the uplift of the Sierra Nevada mountains. There's a lot of geography that contributes to the diversity of velvet ants, but then there's a lot of mimicry and other kinds of ecological evolutionary factors that probably also contributed.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. So many realms of biology are undergoing a similar kind of evolution of understanding in terms of what species are where and how many there
exactly
are. But I was just amazed to see that there are at least in the neighborhood of 450 species right now. That's on the same order of magnitude as the number of birds in North America, or well, in the U.S. anyway, where there's maybe what, 700, 750 bird species. So similar numbers.
Exactly. Well, and if you include the nocturnal velvet ants, there might be more similar to that. Yeah. So we think of all the people that know about birds and all the books dedicated to birds, and these velvet ants, which some might argue are cooler than birds, are almost unknown by most people.
So I'd love to hear a little bit more about where all these different species live. What types of habitats, like what's their lifestyle? And I'm guessing it's 450 different lifestyles.
Yeah, well, and so they have one unifying broad lifestyle. So all velvet ants are parasitic. They're actually, I think officially you would call them parasitoids, but the female velvet ants, their life consists of wandering around looking for a host nest. Most of their hosts are other hymenoptera that nest in the ground. So ground nesting bees or other ground nesting wasps. The female velvet ant will dig her way into the nest and lay her egg. And then the baby velvet ant, which looks like a little maggot, will eat the baby bee or the baby wasp that was in that ground nest at its pupal stage or when it's a pretty big host. Velvet ants are parasitic or parasitoidic. They're parasitoids because they actually kill their host. They don't just feed off of it like a tick might feed off of a deer as a parasite. These ones actually kill the host. So all velvet ants around the world are parasitic. Parasitoids. Most of them are parasitoids of other hymenoptera, many of them ground nesting. Most of the specific host-parasite relationships, we don't know. There are some species that have been dug up from various nests. One species in particular, a nocturnal velvet ant, has been found on something like 30 different ground nesting hosts. But for most of the velvet ant diversity, we are not sure what their host is. For those that we do know, most of them are on bees and wasps, and that with many exceptions. But yeah, so that does unify them. As far as habitat goes, velvet ants are going to be more common and more diverse where their hosts are more common and more diverse. And so bees and many wasps are more diverse in the drier parts of the world. In North America, that includes the deserts and the Mediterranean areas. So out west, there is a lot more velvet ant diversity than in the east. In the northeast, there's one or two species. In Arizona, there's hundreds of species, sometimes dozens of species in one stretch of road. But they're often in kind of areas with open ground, so not densely foliated ground. They like bare patches of dirt because they're searching around in these bare patches of dirt for nests. There's a little bit of a bias there because velvet ant researchers find them more in open patches of dirt because it's easy to see them. If you're walking through a dense scrubland, you might not see the velvet ants crawling underneath the dense bushes. But as far as we can tell, diversity is higher and abundance is higher in these dry, open areas.
So do ground nesting Hymenoptera prefer the more dry open areas?
They do, yes. In fact, like for a bee statistic, which is informative in this discussion, in the US, everything east of the Mississippi River has about 750 bee species. About 70% of those are ground nesting. So 750 bee species east of the Mississippi. Utah alone has about 1,100 bee species. And most of that is concentrated in southern Utah, where it's dry, sandy soils. There's in the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which is in southern Utah, we found 660 different bee species. So almost as many bee species as the entire U.S. live in one national monument in southern Utah.
Wow.
Pinnacles National Monument, or I guess now National Park in California, similarly high diversity in that kind of dry, that's in the Central Valley, dry hills with a lot of bee diversity.
I know that area well. I look forward to visiting it here soon, I hope.
Nice.
What you just described, does it also apply to the nocturnal velvet ants? Or in what ways do the nocturnal velvet ants differ?
As far as their kind of ecology goes, it's very similar as far as we know. Less is known about the nocturnals because they're at night and we don't see them very much. The females are still parasitic. They still are mostly hunting the nests of ground nesting Hymenoptera. The difference is that most people are familiar with brightly colored velvet ants. They're red and black or yellow and black. The nocturnal ones are almost all just a dull brown. So yeah, but biologically, they're still doing the same. They're still more diverse in the Western deserts, partly because you need to be somewhere warm if you're nocturnal, but also for the same reasons as the diurnal velvet ants, their hosts are more diverse in the deserts.
Yeah, and I suppose in the deserts, it's almost too warm, and that's why they're nocturnal, like too warm in the day.
That is one hypothesis about why there's so many nocturnal species in the deserts, is because it could be a way to escape some of the environmental pressures and diversify that way. It could also be a way to escape some of the competition among other parasitic organisms, like other velvet ant species even, because the diurnal velvet ants are out in the day, and so if you could be out in the night, you could be parasitizing the nests before someone else gets to it.
So I think you answered a bit of this question already without me asking it, but if people want to seek out velvet ants, how can they do it? What approaches would you recommend?
I've thought about this a lot because I've spent the last almost 20 years now looking for bees, but also looking for velvet ants. And where I have the best luck is velvet ants, specifically the diurnal velvet ants, are more active kind of in the late summer. So often, I mean, there are some exceptions, but often it's going to be June or even July through maybe October. And they are often most active, not in the hottest part of the day. Me and Kevin and Aaron, which are the three of us that authored this book, we have the best luck in the evening. So maybe early evening, 6 o'clock p.m. through sundown. We look for dry areas. Often the sides of dirt roads are really good. Sand dunes are also quite good for finding them. In the east and in the Midwest, if you can find a sandy area that has sandy soil and go out in the evening, that's where we've had the best luck. And then we just walk up and down the sides of the road or trails and look at the ground and watch for velvet ants crawling by. The same thing is true for the nocturnal ones. We just have to do it with a flashlight and walk really slow, because in that case, you're looking for a little brown velvet ant crawling along the ground rather than a red fuzzy one.
Yeah, really interesting. Your description of that matches my own kind of casual observation. I've never actively sought out velvet ants. It's always been happenstance for me, and it tends to match everything that you're talking about there, with the exception of nocturnal velvet ants, which I'd never seen and never looked for. So.
Yeah. Well, and you can find the nocturnal male velvet ants because they'll fly to your porch light. They'll fly to a black light. We used to use the cheap camping lanterns that had a fluorescent bulb in them because they would attract velvet ants, but not as many moths and beetles. Mm. But yeah, the nocturnal velvet ants, and there's pictures in our book, but the males are winged. And so they look like a brownish wasp of some kind.
Yeah, I do a little bit of UV moth lighting, quote unquote, because other things are attracted to. And so I guess it will happen sooner or later. And
yeah.
And the one crazy exception to all of this, I can't recall the species, but there was one afternoon in my backyard and a little velvet ant just went walking across my patio. They'll even show up in a yard, I suppose, once in a while.
Yeah. And I've noticed the same thing in mine. And I've noticed patterns that certain velvet ants are more common in yards than others. So I'm guessing yours was in the genus Timula, which if you have the, I don't know if you have my book around.
Yeah,
you,
but, it's right here.
I'm just going to pause here for those of people listening so I can tell you where to look. There are not a ton of species of Timula in North America, but they're basically the head and thorax is red and the abdomen is black.
I could probably look it up on iNaturalist very quickly and see.
Oh yeah, you should.
See what people claimed it to be. I'm not, when I was looking at the photos in your book and how similar so many different species are, I started to question how accurate some of the identifications have been on iNaturalist.
It is really hard, except for the fact that Kevin Williams, who's the lead author on this book, is an avid iNaturalist user. And he has basically an encyclopedia of velvet ants. So he can look at the pictures on iNaturalist and not just look for certain characteristics, but also sort through this encyclopedic knowledge he has in his head to know what species are in that area, what species might be in that area, and which ones really won't. So if you have a velvet ant ID on iNaturalist, most likely Kevin has looked at it, and most likely it's pretty accurate.
Well, I'll tell you what, I just found it, and Kevin Williams identified it. I'm probably going to butcher the name. Dasimutala coccinea herta.
Okay, yeah, so I say Dasimutala coccinea herta.
Coccinea herta, okay.
Which is interesting because that one, when I lived in Reno, that one was in my backyard. So that's a species that only lives in California and then gets over into Reno, because Reno actually has a lot of plants and animals that are only known from the Central Valley of California and Reno for some reason.
Interesting.
So yeah, that was another one I guess I've seen in my yard. It wasn't Timula. If you look in your book on page 114, that's what the Timula looked like.
Okay. Yeah, that was an exciting day, though. I never thought I'd see a velvet ant in my yard. And I went to try to get my kids, and they're so quick. I had no idea where they had
really
gone
fast
by the time I came back. So actually, that's a question. And I have some listener questions as well. What kind of range mm-hmm. does an individual velvet ant occupy? Are they just searching constantly with no range, or do they stay in a specific area?
So we actually don't know. And I've always wanted to do a study when I follow one. And kind of map, like turn on my own personal GPS and follow it to see how far it's going in a day. The tricky part is when you start to follow a velvet ant, they run away. And often they'll run away and bury themselves because they see you as a threat. We think they walk quite a bit because that's their whole life, is to walk around until it finds the host nest. And as you can imagine, so a ground nesting bee nest entrance might only be a quarter of an inch in diameter for a big one. And so they're searching this vast landscape of ground looking for a quarter inch sized nest. So they're just going to be randomly walking around. There is a lot of chemosensory stuff going on that we really haven't investigated. You look at their antennae while they're walking and they're tapping them across along the ground. So I'm sure they're trying to, there's some kind of chemical senses they're looking for in these nests. But so we don't know how far an individual will go in its life or even in a day, but they do wander a lot. But that being said, as far as range goes, if you look at range in a different way, many velvet ants are pretty isolated to a certain patch of ground. There are some species that are only on sand dunes. Other species are going to be more flexible in their kind of habitat they will find. A lot of species are going to be more commonly encountered on sand, and maybe that's because there's a lot of hosts that prefer to nest in sand.
And as I said, I put a call out to listeners and I got a few questions I'd like to share with you. The first one here is, why do they look like ants? And my silly little basic assumption is, well, they're all hymenoptera, so they all have a similar body plan, but maybe it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, no, I think that's the definitely the base of all this, is they are related to all hymenoptera and all hymenoptera look similar. They look more like ants partially because they're wingless. The females are wingless. And with these kind of ancient evolutionary stories that we try to tell, we don't know exactly why they're wingless, but there are many benefits to them being wingless. One is that the females are parasitic, digging into other nests. So the wings really aren't helpful for that lifestyle. We see other kind of wasps with similar lifestyles that spend a lot of time crawling on the ground, even when they have wings. So the winglessness could be because the wings weren't really advantageous and they were lost evolutionarily, which is the oversimplification of how evolution works, but the basic story of it. One other thing that velvet ants have that most other wasps don't is they are really heavily armored. velvet ants take, so someone actually did this study to see how much force it takes to crush a velvet ant, and it's about 11 times as much force to crush a velvet ant compared to a honeybee. So they're heavily armored, and part of that armor is their thorax, which where wings are attached. The thorax has been fused into one single plate on the top of the thorax. If you look closely at almost every other bee, wasp, or ant, their thorax is made up of 10 or so different plates with seams in between those plates. The seams each represent a weak spot. And if you are trying to resist being chewed up by something, all of those weak spots will make you more likely to be chewed up. So evolutionarily, velvet ants evolved this heavy armor with no seams on their plate, which also doesn't allow for any attachment for wings. So we don't know exactly the process of how velvet ants lost wings, but they resemble ants because of all these kind of features they have that makes them really effective parasites. Velvet ants are one of the most highly defended wasps, and we could talk about that later, or is this a fine time to talk about some of their defenses?
Yeah, let's talk about it.
So we talked about their armor. They have a really thick exoskeleton. In fact, as an entomologist, I pin a lot of insects. Dead insects, you put them on a pin and you put them in the collection for future study. Velvet ants are actually pretty difficult to stick a pin through because their exoskeleton is thick and it's also slippery. So the pin will sometimes graze off of the exoskeleton and stab me in the finger just because they have that armor. So that's one kind of defense they have. They're heavily armored. We mentioned the stinger earlier. They have a really long stinger with a potent venom. So they're heavily armored. They have a really effective weapon. And unlike most wasps, that they can only sting you if they can get their abdomen at you, the velvet ant's stinger is as long as its abdomen. So no matter where you grab them, they can sting you with a painful sting. They also have their hair, which is often brightly colored, which is a warning to predators. Aposematic coloration is the phrase. So they have this warning coloration. They also have an auditory defense. They can, the technical term is stridulation, but they can squeak. So on their abdomen, they have different plates and they can rub those plates together and it makes a pretty loud squeaking sound. So predators will hear that squeak. Well, here's the story that we've seen through experimentation. A lizard that's never seen a velvet ant will come up and bite the velvet ant, thinking it's good prey. The hard exoskeleton of the velvet ant makes it so the lizard can't crush it immediately. So the lizard has it in its mouth. The velvet ant then stings it on the inside of the mouth, and which is quite painful for the lizard. The lizard will release the velvet ant, see the bright colors, hear the stridulation, and generally never try again. We've done this with one lizard. We let it experience the velvet ant's defenses and then didn't give it any velvet ants, kept it in a tank and kept it alive and happy for a year. The next year, we gave it a velvet ant again, and it wouldn't even look at it. So I don't know how long lizards remember, but at least it remembered for a year, don't mess with a velvet ant.
Actually, that I think that answers the next question that I had was, why the powerful sting? Is there a hypothesis as to the purpose of the sting?
So the sting of wasps in general, broadly, wasps are predators, and they hunt with their sting. So their sting is to immobilize or kill their prey. Many wasps use their sting to paralyze the prey. Then they bring that paralyzed prey back to their nest to feed their babies. Velvet ants are unique among wasps because their prey is already basically immobile. They don't necessarily need to paralyze it because it's a pupa in a ground underground nest. We think that velvet ants' sting still has a hunting purpose. There are one, maybe two studies that suggest when the velvet ant stings its host, it might stop the development of that host. So if the host is in a pupa, it's going to freeze it in time. So it's going to stay a pupa until it gets eaten instead of continue the pupation process. So it seems like it might be basically paralyzing that prey. But we think that the velvet ant's sting, like many wasp stings, but maybe more in a velvet ant sting, is for defense against predation. If you've ever been stung by a wasp or a bee, you know that those stings can be pretty effective defenses. But the velvet ant sting is cool because it can sting something, get released because it has such a hard exoskeleton, and continue its life. So it's training these predators really quickly not to mess with it.
As demonstrated by that lizard of yours. Okay, next on the list, and it's only two more. Okay, this listener said, I assume that they are solitary creatures since I rarely see more than one at a given time. Is that accurate?
Yeah, so these are solitary. Well, in fact, most wasp species, just like most bee species, are solitary. The social ones are the exception, but velvet ants are solitary, yes. They are solitary, though if you find one, you are more likely to, and you spend some time in that area, you'll probably see more, because that's probably where their hosts are. So they are solitary, but maybe patchily distributed, not uniformly distributed across the landscape.
Got it. Again, with that common name of ant, people probably have a little bit of an expectation that there's going to be a colony, or it's not the case.
Well, yeah, nothing like that. There's not even really a velvet ant nest. Because they're parasitic, they're not building their own nest. So they're basically just vagabonds that are wandering the landscape, sometimes sleeping in just a hole that they dig themselves, sometimes potentially sleeping in their host nest. We don't know where the males sleep.
Speaking of males, the last question was, I've never seen a male velvet ant. Why is this? Are they reclusive or simply don't stand out in the same way?
Because they fly, we don't see them. It's like a different search image. I guess there's a couple different potential answers to this, and we're not exactly sure, but they fly. And so they're spending their time flying zigzags along the ground, maybe following pheromone trails to the females. But because they're flying, you don't notice them as velvet ants, even though many of them are brightly colored like the females. But when it's flying, it just looks like maybe a black wasp flying by. So you don't notice it. Some people notice them on certain flowers. Often you'll see male velvet ants on milkweed flowers, but just for nectar. The other option is that, well, there's two other options of why we don't see them. One is there could be a skewed sex ratio. There could be more velvet ant female eggs laid than male eggs laid, because males, really their whole job is to impregnate a female and then that's it. The females, like most Hymenoptera, store the sperm alive, and they can use the sperm when they want it to lay a fertilized egg or an unfertilized egg. Side note here, Hymenoptera can choose if they're laying a male egg or a female egg. Male eggs are unfertilized, female eggs are fertilized. But so the males are not playing a big role in the environment other than impregnating a female. And so it could be that their females are laying more female eggs. So there's a skewed sex ratio. The other thing is the males likely don't live as long. Some female velvet ants, at least in captivity, live over a year. And I think that's true in the wild too sometimes, because I've seen some that are really pretty tattered. So I think they're more than a year old. They at least live several weeks to several months. Males, even in captivity, rarely live more than a few weeks.
Oh, wow.
So it could just be that the males are not as long lived, so we don't see them.
Why don't we get into the book a little bit more directly? So yeah. Tell me about the book. When did it come out and what was its goal?
This book, which came out in, mid-February 2024. So it's out now.
Yeah. Case in point, I have my copy right here.
Oh, nice. Perfect. Yeah. So it is out. And so this has been in the works for several years. So me and Kevin, who's the lead author on the book, we were in graduate school together. He was studying the kind of evolution and systematics of these brightly colored velvet ants. I was studying kind of the biogeography and historical ecology of the nocturnal velvet ants. And we worked on with each other throughout graduate school and after on various velvet ant projects. But then we have a friend, Aaron Pan, who is also an author on this book. He's a naturalist of all kinds. His PhD work was on plant fossil assemblages in Africa, I believe. But he's published and does work on lots of different things, from marine mollusks to bees to plant fossils. But he lives in North Texas, which is a hot spot of diversity for velvet ants. And so he was always interested in velvet ants and collecting them and photographing them and working with me and Kevin on various kind of just side projects. And he thought it would be really neat to do kind of a book about velvet ants in the western short grasslands, which is North Texas, because there's just so much there. And he thought that'd be really cool to see, because he was seeing all this diversity in his area. And so we started looking into this and thought, well, let's just do one to North America. I have common bees of Eastern North America and common bees of Western North America field guides. So I knew this process of field guides. I knew Kevin with his encyclopedic knowledge of velvet ants and Aaron with his kind of naturalist skills, that we together could make this book pretty good that really no one else has the ability to do, because they don't have the same set of knowledge, especially that Kevin has. Kevin has just spent his life gaining this knowledge. And so One of the cool things about velvet ant, all three of us have published extensively on mimicry in velvet ants. Velvet ants make the biggest Mullerian mimicry complex that has been described in the world so far. Mullerian mimicry is when two harmful things look like each other when they live in the same area, because that trains predators fast. And we've described this large velvet ant mimicry complex. What the mimicry does is it means that when you're in Texas, there's like 10 different species that look just like each other. They're not necessarily closely related to each other, but they have evolved the same color pattern. Same thing in Southern California. There are several species that are white and fluffy in Southern California, but in other parts of their range, there might be different colors. To make a field guide to this is tricky because you have all these species that look like each other, but they're not necessarily related to each other. And as an avid field guide user, we came up with this idea that, so a lot of wildflower field guides organize their field guide based on color. If you're looking at a white flower, you go to this section of the book, or a red flower, you go to this section of the book. And so we thought we should do this with velvet ants, because then if you are in Texas and you see a velvet ant that is the head and thorax is black and the abdomen is orange, you go to that section of the book and you can tell them apart using more technical aspects. And so we designed the book that way initially, but we also had to expand it because you need to know some of the taxonomy with the different genera and things like that in velvet ants. And then males sometimes look like the females. Sometimes they look different than the females. So we have one chapter on females and a separate chapter on males organized by color pattern rather than just taxonomy.
Yeah, it seems like I've only had the book for a few days now. It seems like it would be very handy in that respect. And I'm really motivated to pay more attention and look for velvet ants and put it to the test this year.
And it is somewhat technical because they're not the simplest group to identify. It's not like birds that you can just look for the color of the chest of the bird and know what it is. There are a lot of, and we have some of that information in the book. Some of this stuff is going to be, you need a microscope to look at.
I saw that called out.
Or sometimes you need a specimen to look at. Yeah. And so we tried to be clear, but we also wanted this to be useful for future scientists or for current scientists, that there was no resource to look up to identify velvet ants. And so we wanted this to be really applicable to all kinds of people.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say about the book?
I don't think so. I guess I'll just give people a warning that I just basically gave, but give it some time. There's going to be some technical stuff in here, but we tried to make this nice balance, and Kevin was really good at this, of mixing some of the lightheartedness of velvet ants with some of the technical aspects. In each species, we have the etymology, like where the name came from, because that's interesting to know why they named it that. We also have field identification tips, so when you're looking at a live specimen, what to look for. Lab identification tips when you have a microscope, and then some notes about it. So some species, there's more extensive notes, interesting side fun facts, and sometimes the note is, we don't know anything about this species. If you're getting this book and hoping to identify velvet ants, some of them will become really easy, and sometimes it's going to be tricky. Mm-hmm. I think the same is true for any organism. Birds, some birds are easy. Sparrows are not always easy.
And yeah, you're right about the lightheartedness. That did come through in the bits and pieces that I read as well. And I was also surprised to learn that people keep velvet ants as pets, and it's not that difficult. It sounds like another interesting avenue.
I often have some in my office, but not right now.
Okay. All right. So what have you found to be most effective in moving people up a rung in environmental awareness?
It's a good question. And I think it's a challenge that a lot of conservation biologists face. And one thing I've noticed with bees and hopefully with velvet ants is that there's maybe a more natural curiosity. You see, historically, I'm talking historically, like in the last 50 years, there's a lot of environmental movements. And one of their main challenges is to get people to like their organism, like saving the whales. Most people maybe haven't had that much experience with whales. And so part of this conservation movement is to convince people that whales are worth saving. They're important because of these reasons. With bees, that has already been done. People know bees are important. With velvet ants, nobody knows about them. So we are trying to introduce them to the world and convince people that they're worthwhile. And I think the way to do that with every conservation movement, but especially with insects, is to tell stories. And that's why we tried to include that in each species, a kind of a fun facts section. Because once you are aware of the organism and you maybe feel like you have a little connection because you know, oh, these ones only live in the sand dunes in Southern California, or these ones only live in Florida. Once you have a little bit of a story, then it connects us all together and makes it more, it's easier to want to preserve something if you are introduced to it. You know its name and you know where it lives. And so with bees, it's easy to convince people bees are important because of food and pollination. But with velvet ants, our goal is to say, look how cool these things are. This is what they are. This is what they do. This is how you can tell them apart. And hopefully that will raise awareness, which I think, to answer your question and use your ladder metaphor, it does take people up a rung on that ladder because now they know what they are and they can have this goal in mind. Next time they're hiking in Pinnacles National Monument or National Park, they might have their eye open for a velvet ant and know to look for them and be fascinated by the squeak.
That's so true in so many levels. I think about like even something that most people like, a lady beetle, for example. So many people think that a lady beetle, like there's just one species of lady beetle, or maybe there's a couple species. I think some people know about the Asian lady beetle now as well. Yeah. But when they start to learn there are so many different species with different names and different lifestyles, then that just opens up another door. And it's special at that point. It's no longer the thing that you just take for granted.
Exactly.
If you could magically impart one ecological concept to help the public see the world like you see it, what might that be?
Yeah, and there's lots of concepts I wish people could fall in love with and understand more. But one that I'll bring up because we're focused on velvet ants is this idea of parasites. Colloquially, parasites are bad, right? Nobody is going to call someone a parasite as a compliment. But we have this misconception that parasites are the enemy. That's true for bees and for velvet ants. There are several kinds of parasitic bees that will parasitize the nest of other bees. Velvet ants are all parasites. And so we think of them, it's easy to think of them as the bad guys, right? These guys are digging into a bee's nest and killing its baby. That sounds like a bad guy. But ecologically, parasites are playing a really, really important role in a healthy ecosystem. Yes, if you have too many parasites, it's bad. But if you don't have any parasites, it's also bad. Because parasites help keep this balance in an ecosystem. And that balance is what equates to a healthy ecosystem. So that one bit of information I wish people would understand is that parasites are playing important roles in the ecosystem, even though it sounds harsh.
Yeah, I like that. It's part of the fabric of the ecosystem that holds it together and strengthens it.
Exactly.
So do you have any upcoming projects that you'd like to highlight?
I'll tell you about one. I will highlight that if you are interested in bees, the bees in your backyard is a good starter, right? But now there are some field guides that are slightly more technical, the Eastern and the Western field guides. So I am shifting my focus now away from books and back to the more academic peer-reviewed publications. I do like scientific publications, and it's a fun part of being a professor. One of the studies, and I'll just mention this briefly, it's not about velvet ants, it's back to a bee study, but I've been interested in a long time at how many bees get killed by cars every year or whatever. And so over the past like 3 or 4 years, I've put a little sticky trap on the front bumper of my car in the summer when I go on family vacations or when I'm going out in the field. And I would measure how many bees I hit with that little sticky trap. It's like maybe half of a square foot. And then I do some kind of interpolation to upscale that sticky trap to say, okay, well, how many bees did I hit with my entire car potentially or with the whole bumper? Anyway, I've had that paper done now and submitted, but it turns out, and I can only speak for Utah because all my trips were just based in Utah because I have traffic data for Utah. But based on how many bees I hit, based on the average daily traffic in Utah, it is tens of millions of bees getting hit and killed by cars every day. So across the whole summer, that's hundreds of millions or even billions of bees getting killed, which sounds like a lot, but based on this study, it seems like that is the pattern that we see. And I think in places like Southern California, where there's high bee diversity, or places around Phoenix, Arizona, where there's high bee diversity and quite a bit of traffic, is something to be aware of. But especially because a lot of conservation-minded people are proposing planting pollinator habitat on the sides of roads. And in this paper, we address this, but and I'm not against pollinator habitat on the roads, but it needs to be done wisely. If you only have pollinator habitat on one side of the road, or even worse, in the center median, pollinators are needing to cross lanes of traffic to get to those floral resources. So if you're going to plant pollinator habitat, it should be on both sides of the road. And studies show that if it's on both sides, the pollinators will fly longitudinally along the road rather than trying to cross. Mm. So I think that, that's a study I'm just excited about because it's just mind-boggling to think how many bees potentially are being hit all the time.
I've become very interested in wildlife connectivity and road ecology, and mm-hmm. have had a number of guests on the podcast talking about different aspects of this. Ben Goldfarb had a book on road ecology, and yeah, the impact to insects is so overlooked, but so immense. I bet you he'll be excited to see this paper.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. It's currently with the journal, hopefully being reviewed. I'm hoping in the next couple months it'll come out, because it's just hopefully will raise awareness. Not to say that we shouldn't drive, because it's a necessity in the way that our culture has established itself, but to be aware of what these roads, especially through some of these native habitat, does.
Right. And if it can inform some smarter plantings and a little different design that helps mitigate the problem, that's great. That's a good outcome. So if people want to follow your work, learn about it when this paper comes out and other research that you do, where can they go?
Yeah. So since we started our first book, The Bees in Your Backyard, we started a website also called thebeesinyourbackyard.com. And then social media, meaning me and Olivia, but often I'm the one that's doing the social media posts. We have Instagram, it's The Bees in Your Backyard with underscores. We have a Facebook page called The Bees in Your Backyard. And we do have a Twitter formerly known as Twitter, an X account. I'm not as active on that. It's just harder to maintain or harder to me to be enthusiastic about it. But it's also, I think if you looked up The Bees in Your Backyard, but I think our X handle is @beesbackyard. Often I'll just post the same things on all three of those social media sites. I did start a YouTube channel a couple years ago, but I've really not been active on it. I find that it's more fun for me to do the research than to just do a video about me doing the research. I keep meaning to be more active on social media, but sometimes I'd rather just do the work. But anyway, so I do have a lot of good resources on those social media platforms or on our website. So you should look at it and just don't expect me to post every day if you're going to follow it.
I'll make sure to link to all of that and also all the different books that you mentioned. I'm glad that you were able to work in the field guides, the common bee field guides, into the discussion as well. Those will all be in the show notes too.
Awesome.
And I guess we're about wrapping up. So is there anything else that you were hoping to talk about today that maybe we didn't get to?
No, I think we've talked about all my passions, mostly. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, at least.
All right.
I appreciate it. It's been fun.
Yeah, Dr. Wilson, it has been a lot of fun. I can feel your enthusiasm and your passion, as you said, for this topic. I think that's going to shine through, and I'm looking forward to getting this out and released. So thank you again.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you.
Hey, it's Michael here. I've heard it from several of you that you'd like to hear more insect-based episodes, and I do have a few coming up soon. But there are some other great podcasts out there that I've come across or I've interacted with, one of which is called Just Bugs. They reached out to me, and they're going to use one of my grasshopper photos for an upcoming episode that they have. Xerces Society has a new podcast called Bug Banter that came out earlier this year. Bugs Need Heroes is a great one as well. They recently interviewed Kevin Weiner from All Bugs Go to Kevin on Facebook that I've mentioned before on the podcast. So hopefully that will tide you over, and be sure to check those out. Thanks for sticking through the entire episode. If you made it this far, I hope that it means that you enjoyed it. If so, please spread the word and share this episode with three friends or groups that you think would enjoy it too. As for today's episode, let me know, did I miss anything? Was there a topic I should have covered? Let me know at podcast@jumpstartnature.com or DM me on any of my social accounts. I'll do my best to answer your questions. You can find me @Nature's Archive, one word, on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I also share photography, nature stories, and much more on those accounts, so you can follow just to stay in touch, too. And despite being called crazy by numerous friends and colleagues, last year I left my tech career behind to start Jumpstart Nature, which Nature's Archive is now part of. For the sake of myself, my family, and the planet, I need to make this work, so please also consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/jumpstartnature. I offer some exclusive content and perks, and you can start donations as low as $4 a month. Lastly, please also check out our latest creation. It's the Jumpstart Nature podcast. We just completed our pilot season, where each episode reveals an unseen, surprising, or misunderstood nature topic with the help of experts and our host, Griff Griffith. It's entertaining and inspiring, and even reached number 3 on the Apple Nature podcast charts.
There's much more on our roadmap, but we need your support. So check out jumpstartnature.com for more details. Thank you.